You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. So we are to what? We're now in the 11th week of sheltering in, and it is getting very, very old. My kids are going stir crazy. My wife said, I love you, but, you know, I'm getting sick of you. And about a couple of weeks ago, I started just watching different kinds of television programs, and I just came across The West Wing. It's crazy. I'm thinking so much about West Wing and about the role of government and what it means. And for me, there was this thing about the State of the Union, and they were trying to decide whether they were going to put in a line about big government is dead.
We decided to offend poor people?
The people we're offending won't be watching the State of the Union.
Yeah, I can't imagine why not.
And this episode rang particularly true for me personally in terms of how I look at the world. And I believe government can be a force for good. And I think there is a role for government. You know, I think if anything else, COVID-19 has shown what good governance can do.
Tomorrow night, we do an immense thing. We have to say what we feel. That government, no matter what its failures in the past and in times to come, for that matter, government can be a place where people come together and where no one gets left behind. No one gets left behind.
And it was one of these sort of inspiring moments that it was the notion that leadership mattered, that government can be a force for good. And that's what I think leadership is about, right? This week, we're going to take a closer look at leadership. Some political leaders are seizing this moment and saving lives. Some are failing the very communities that need them the most. And some are taking this crisis as an opportunity to make things better. Better by talking about how we can use this pandemic to reimagine capitalism itself and advance systemic change. First, we go to the other side of the world, to New Zealand. Their prime minister has been called one of the most effective leaders in the world today. Producer Teresa Katsourilis takes it from here.
I want you to think back to late March for a moment. The World Health Organization had declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. California, Oregon, and Washington had just started sheltering in place. And around the same time, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern decided to address her nation. Her country had about 28 confirmed cases.
The address that Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister, made that day on the 21st of March, and the style of the address and the way it was done, it was unprecedented.
I'm speaking directly to all New Zealanders today to give you as much certainty and clarity as we can as we fight COVID-19.
It was in her office. She spoke directly to New Zealanders, looking straight down the barrel of the camera.
Over the past few weeks, the world has changed.
Political commentators have said, you know, this type of address is traditionally reserved for times of war.
Indira Stewart is a veteran journalist in New Zealand. She hosts the 5 a.m. show First Up on RNZ Radio.
Lock down now. That's what more than 20,000 people who've signed a petition want to happen.
For the past 2 months, she's been in lockdown. We called each other on Zoom from our homes on May 14th, the day that lockdown lifted.
Things just happened really fast. So for the first time in history, the government closed its borders to the rest of the world. When she spoke on Saturday, she introduced a four-level alert system. The higher the number, the more strict the conditions were. By Monday afternoon, she announced the country was then at alert level 3, and that was effective immediately. Schools closed, retailers, cafes, restaurants and bars. Within about 48 hours, the entire country would go into alert level 4. So at Wednesday, 11:59 p.m., the country went into lockdown. I suppose waking up on the first day of lockdown was very strange, that there was just no traffic. New Zealand had 155 confirmed cases at the time. So even between the 19th of March, which was 28 cases, to just a few days later at 155 cases, the exponential growth of cases here was already quite obviously beginning.
Just to put that in context for a minute, the United States had over 4,000 confirmed cases by the time President Trump issued social guidelines. And those are just guidelines. The U.S. has never fully locked down like this. I gotta say, It's fascinating to me that New Zealand responded so aggressively to the pandemic so early, particularly in comparison to other countries. As you just mentioned, the country only had a few dozen or so confirmed cases when Prime Minister Ardern addressed the nation. So why do you think New Zealand decided to lock down the country so quickly and take this aggressive approach?
Well, what we've heard from epidemiologists is that, you know, the level of preparedness that New Zealand had to tackle a pandemic was not that great at the time. And the tracing system at the time was also not up to standards. The aim of the government at the time was not to manage the virus, but they clearly stated that the goal of New Zealand was to eliminate the virus. Now, it means that there are either no new cases or near to no new cases, and the cases that are new are those that are coming in from overseas.
At least so far, that's exactly what New Zealand has done. The country has suffered a little over 1,500 confirmed cases and 21 deaths. As of this reporting, those numbers are not going up.
We have done what very few countries have been able to do. We have stopped a wave of devastation.
Today, we have moved to level two. So schools open back up on Monday. The majority of businesses will open back up.
Turning now to New Zealand, where people have been getting a sense of what it's like to get back to business as lockdown there is lifted.
There are a couple reasons that New Zealand's initial lockdown was so successful. This is a small island nation. Around 5 million people live here, and sheep outnumber people 6 to 1. New Zealand can isolate itself more easily than other countries with land borders. Its cities are less densely populated. And as Indira points out, luck probably had something to do with this too. But global public health experts agree that New Zealand's early and aggressive lockdown was a game changer here. And the success of that policy can be traced back to Prime Minister Ardern herself. One of the first things I want to talk about is Jacinda Ardern's leadership style, because she really strikes me as one of a kind. She's the youngest female leader in the world.
I just hope I'm not cutting into executive time.
I'm a woman, I multitask, so do not worry, that is expected.
She used to be a DJ.
How do you pick your one favourite Beatles song? I just pick the one that I remember made me love the Beatles from that day forward while I was at high school. So I hope you enjoy this first track.
The Atlantic just called her the most effective leader on the planet. What makes her so unique?
I suppose as a woman, it's been really quite amazing and interesting to watch a female prime minister like Jacinda Ardern. We still face gender issues here in New Zealand. There's still a significant gender pay gap, and even the gender ratio in parliament is still very significant. She attracted a lot of younger audiences, younger voters as well, because she was younger and she got pregnant, and that got a lot of attention of different people.
But what has really raised eyebrows worldwide is she's pregnant.
I'm looking forward to the day when we won't have news stories about that, because it won't be nearly as unusual. But for now, I accept that that's just the way it is.
She had a baby, and just the things that happened in the last 3 years certainly have boosted the attention because to her style of leadership. So we've had three national crises, I suppose you could say, during her time in Parliament as a leader.
Ardern's first crisis, the Christchurch terror attacks.
A gunman with an automatic weapon has opened fire on a mosque in central Christchurch.
People start running out, and the door is closed, and the guards turn on them and start shooting them.
49 people are known to have died.
The death count later rose to 51 people.
It happened in 2019, it was just a year ago. And then last year in December, there was a Whakaari White Island volcano here that erupted.
A Sydney family of four is missing after the White Island volcano eruption.
And there were about 50 people that were on the island at the time. 21 people died, most of them tourists, and 26 people suffered injuries and burns.
These disasters have shaped Prime Minister Ardern, and they've informed her approach to our current moment. Indira says she excels at connecting with people in times of crisis. You could really see it after the Christchurch terror attacks.
So there was trust building among, you know, New Zealanders during those periods because of her response to those crises. She's been praised as being one of the most effective communicators. One image that went viral around the world at the Christchurch terror attack is her, you know, wearing a scarf over her head and attending a private meeting just with the Muslim community.
Assalamu alaikum, and can I acknowledge all of the community leaders who are here who have taken the time.
Just that powerful image of her providing support by putting on a scarf was almost perceived as her uniting with the Muslim community. Just the simple act of putting a scarf. And what followed was within days, you know, you'd see reporters on TV wearing scarves. And when the National Memorial Service happened, there were a lot of non-Muslim women in New Zealand who were showing up to that service in scarves as well.
We're coming together as a community, not just the Muslim community, all of New Zealand.
Ardern translated that sense of solidarity into immediate political action. Within a month of the Christchurch terror attacks, her government had implemented wide-reaching gun reforms.
Today I'm announcing that New Zealand will ban all military-style semi-automatic weapons.
That ban passed Parliament almost unanimously. Ardern is still advocating for a second round of gun laws, which would include a national firearms registry and stricter penalties for non-compliance. You brought up something that I think is really interesting and a very powerful aspect of Ardern's approach, and that is the way she projects solidarity with the people that she governs. When you were describing that Christchurch picture, the first thing I thought of was that video of Prime Minister Ardern addressing the country in her sweatpants after putting her child to bed.
Excuse the casual attire. It's can be a messy business putting toddlers to bed, so I'm not in my work clothes, so forgive me for that.
Are you talking about the one after the terror attacks or the one during the COVID-19 crisis?
The one, first of all, I love that she's done this more than once.
Yes, she does a lot, actually.
Wait, that's amazing. She regularly addresses the nation in her sweatpants.
Well, part of her effective communication is the Facebook videos. Mothers at home that I've spoken to, they felt like they could relate to her. You know, she literally put her daughter, her baby to bed and sat on her bed in her sweatpants, you know. It's helped them to relate or connect or brought her down to being perhaps, you know, like a normal person.
She wasn't just addressing New Zealanders from her bedroom. Prime Minister Ardern has also held daily press briefings with the country's Director General of Health. And while New Zealand's lockdown wasn't without controversy, it was still widely supported.
The opposition party did criticise that because, as we've seen in other countries around the world, it had a huge economic toll here in New Zealand. But it's interesting to note that the leader of the opposition, I mean, he posted something on Facebook about New Zealand should be going into level 3 earlier. And that post on Facebook received over 20,000 comments, and a lot of them were from his own party supporters, and they were criticising him for saying that. When the opposition party here criticises or questions the government on certain moves or decisions, they receive a lot of backlash.
Indira says essential workers in hospitals and grocery stores told her they didn't always have enough personal protective gear. And there was plenty of pushback against the level 4 lockdown's funeral restrictions, for instance. Initially, only one person was allowed to accompany a body to a crematorium. Right now, funerals are capped at 50 people. Still, as New Zealand tentatively lifts its lockdown, Ardern has the highest approval rating of any prime minister here in a century.
There are still some restrictions, particularly around large gatherings. It's a new normal, but certainly the restrictions have eased significantly since the lockdown came into place on the 25th of March.
Is there anything in particular you're looking forward to doing?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing my sisters. This Saturday, I've planned to meet up with my two sisters for dinner, so I'm really excited about that.
Indira, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
It's lovely chatting with you guys, and wish you all the best and stay safe.
As New Zealand reopened this month, Prime Minister Ardern unveiled a massive public spending package to revive the economy. Though she warned that the country could still lose thousands of jobs, many are dependent on foreign tourism. Ardern is floating the idea of a four-day work week to promote safe domestic tourism here. So the United States, meanwhile, has struggled to respond to this pandemic in a fast and unified way. President Trump downplayed the threat of COVID-19 at first and disregarded advice from his scientific advisors. State governors say they've taken the lead where the federal government has failed to. Public health experts warn some jurisdictions are lifting restrictions too soon. And anti-lockdown protesters are urging local governments to lift them sooner.
A lot of people live in a bubble in which COVID-19 is really nothing more than the flu, has been wildly exaggerated by irresponsible journalists like me.
Nicholas Kristof is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and columnist for The New York Times. He was raised on a sheep and cherry farm in Yamhill, Oregon.
So Yamhill is a little farm town, population 1,000 on a good day.
Some of the people he grew up with are skeptical of stay-at-home orders and similar restrictions. The pandemic hasn't hit their communities yet, Nick says, but its economic fallout has, and they've already weathered decades of poverty and neglect. Nick explores that neglect in his book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching Hope. He wrote it with the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Cheryl Wu Dunn, who's also his wife. They discussed it with journalist Mina Kim at a World Affairs event in February.
We tell the story partly through my number 6 school bus, full of working class kids whose families had done well. The family that got on the bus right after me was the Knapps, whose dad had a union job laying sewer pipes. The mom worked on a farm, driving tractor. But the jobs went away. Lives imploded. A quarter of the kids on the number 6 bus are now gone because of drugs, alcohol, and suicide.
He said most of the Knapp family's children died that way, too.
Farlan died of liver failure from drug and alcohol use. Zeelan died in a house fire when he was passed out drunk. Regina died of hepatitis from injectable drug use. And Nathan blew himself up cooking meth. The only survivor of the 5 was the youngest, Keelan, and he survived only because he spent 13 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary. That's one family on my bus, and there were a lot more. Those kids just went through an inferno.
Nick and his wife Cheryl argue that this cycle of addiction, despair, and suicide can be traced back to economic policies.
Yamhill is lily white. And in Yamhill, and I think in a lot of white communities in the 1990s, there were a lot of disparaging comments made about African Americans and the struggles in African American communities. And people would talk about how the problems were a result of deadbeat dads and people making bad choices and not showing personal responsibility, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No, these pathologies are a consequence of lost jobs. Because when jobs left Yamhill, and when they left Kentucky, when they left Maine, the same patterns unfolded.
Yamhill used to be a successful agricultural and manufacturing town.
So it was, I think, a function of lost jobs and of declining returns for basically the bottom half of the labor force. If you're at the bottom end of the labor force, you're earning less than you were adjusted for inflation in the 1970s.
Nick's former classmates were struggling before the pandemic, along with millions of other Americans. So last week, I asked Nick how they're doing now.
I mean, I'm in the Yamhill right now. I'm on the family farm right now. And in medical terms, it hasn't been hit badly. So the area was not hit badly by COVID. There was some in the Latino community, but not much outside of it. However, the economy stopped, and that has hit people pretty hard. But maybe beyond the unemployment and the loss of incomes as well as jobs is the social isolation. You know, what really got my old classmates in trouble and ended up killing many of them was a combination of lost jobs and social isolation. And what do we have now because of COVID? It's lost jobs and social isolation. One family that I am close to, that I care deeply about, has been wrestling with issues of addiction. And things had been pretty promising. And now that addiction program is suspended, and I don't know where things stand. I hope there hasn't been a relapse, but I worry about it. And another case, somebody who had been doing really, really well, and I believe in, and I think he's going to make it, but he, likewise, he is in a job that is very vulnerable.
His friend's at risk of getting laid off.
I worry a lot that this may cause a relapse to issues of addiction that had mired him for many years. He's done fantastically well and is very smart, is very capable, is supporting his family now instead of us supporting him in prison. Yet that all kind of came crashing down when jobs slowed down.
Nick says the federal government's response to the pandemic is making a long history of bad policy even worse.
For 50 years, the U.S. pursued policies that abandoned people at the bottom end of the socioeconomic spectrum. So we were the only advanced country that didn't have universal health care, the only country that didn't have universal paid sick leave. We took power from labor unions and gave it to corporations. The 1968 federal minimum wage, if it had kept pace with inflation and productivity, would be $22 an hour instead of $7.25. And of course, in that context, people struggle and they often self-medicate. But, you know, that all happened before COVID. And one might have thought that seeing the desperation of approximately 1 in 5 Americans being unemployed now, that maybe the system would respond differently. But I don't see that. You know, you look at the European policy response to this economic crisis, and Europe essentially subsidized jobs to keep people employed. And the U.S., in contrast, has been having people leave their jobs and then paying unemployment. So, and in fact, spending a higher share of GDP to do that with the trauma of unemployment. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is continuing to try to overturn legally Obamacare in ways that would result in millions of people losing health care, and is trying to tighten restrictions on access to food stamps. On the other hand, $135 billion has been allocated as tax breaks for hedge fund moguls and real estate developers, in tax breaks even for past years. We took a crisis that resulted from heartless policies in the past, and that as a result had a particular impact on struggling Americans. And then we magnified that impact by coming up with tax breaks for some of the luckiest Americans and letting tens of millions of people lose their jobs and struggle.
What happens if COVID-19 does make it to Yamhill? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion in working class communities and urban environments about how pre-existing health conditions due to poverty have exacerbated COVID-19 symptoms. What do you think would happen if the virus does reach Yamhill in a significant way?
The working class, whether white or black, has a lot of comorbidities. There's a lot of hypertension, there's a lot of diabetes, there's a lot of obesity, and the result will be pretty devastating if COVID-19 does arrive. And I don't think people appreciate that the best way to safeguard the economy is to beat the disease. That if COVID-19 is raging through a community, there is no way you can keep businesses going. You know, the first priority should be to keep COVID at bay But that's hard to understand if you've got a small restaurant that is going out of business.
This is a little personal, but I hope it's all right that I ask it. What is it like kind of carrying this with you? You know these people so well. You have followed them for years. You've written a book about them. It feels like right now we're in a moment that will get worse before it gets better. How do you carry this?
With a certain amount of guilt, perhaps. I've been blessed everywhere I turn. I've been incredibly lucky, and some of my friends have been incredibly unlucky. In Tightrope, we wrote about a family that I grew up with who was on my bus, the five Knapp kids. And at the time that we wrote the book, four of the five kids had died. And in March, the fifth one, Keelan Knapp, who was really excited by the book and we were going to do a event together, and he really wanted to draw lessons from all that his family had been through. And then in March, Keelan died of a heroin overdose. And was it COVID related? I have no idea, but it certainly is harder to maintain connections with friends at this time, to soothe the pain of losing one's job, of wrestling with economic difficulties, and all the support mechanisms we have involving friends, they are now cut off. And then Keelan's family, of course, couldn't have a funeral for him either. You know, I just find it very frustrating, because I know that intellectually, great crises and traumas have often spurred important new progressive steps, like the Great Depression, leading to the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Progress Administration, Social Security. And that seems like it should happen. I mean, people, you know, it seems like maybe this is the time when we can actually get universal health care, where we can get paid sick leave. But in fact, I look at the consequence of the 2008-2009 financial crisis, and what was it? It was that Wall Street got rescued and 10 million Americans lost their homes. And I look at this crisis, and Wall Street and hedge funds and real estate moguls are getting rescued, and 40% of people in households earning less than $40,000 a year have lost their jobs. And I'm just afraid this is exacerbating inequities, not only financially, but in terms of mortality. And I find that a heartbreaking and a betrayal of the values that we purport to adhere to.
Nick Kristof is an award-winning journalist and columnist for The New York Times. He wrote Tightrope with his wife, the writer Cheryl Wu Dunn.